So I think that the 80s and 90s have kind of led to where we are today with nationalism and with a lot of rhetoric that I think has moved into violence and racism.
Welcome to Dangerous Dogma, the authority on questioning authority. I'm Brian Kaler, president of Word and Way. You can learn more about us at wordandway.org. In this episode, we're going to have a conversation with Sarah Billups. She's author of the brand new book, Orphaned Believers: How a Generation of Christian Exiles Can Find the Way Home. This is a great book and a really fun conversation. I think you're going to enjoy it, and you'll hear both the concern about what has happened, American Christianity, but also a hopeful tone of what it could be. Before we jump into that conversation, I want to remind you that if you haven't already, you really should subscribe to Word and Way's award-winning email newsletter, A Public Witness. We deal with a lot of these similar issues about faith, culture, and politics, and the impact it's having on our churches and our faith. Learn more, subscribe today, publicwitness.wordandway.org. Now here's my conversation with Sarah Billups on Orphaned Believers. Well, Sarah, first of all, welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me. I'm so happy to be here.
Yeah, I'm excited to talk with you about your new book, Orphaned Believers: How a Generation of Christian Exiles Can Find the Way Home. And it's an excellent book. I really encourage people to check it out. But let's start with the title. You have this idea of orphaned believers. What do you mean by that, and particularly this idea of the double orphaned?
Yeah, well, when I use the term orphaned believer, what I mean is a Christian looking around the American church right now and wondering where Jesus is. You know, I think about a sort of spiritual orphaning where maybe we live in the Bible Belt. I mean, I grew up in the Bible Belt, and look around the pews, and maybe we hear some political rhetoric or we hear other kind of talk, but not a lot of formative arrows pointing back towards the radical life of Jesus. Or maybe we live in a city like I do now in Seattle, where it's uncommon to identify as a Christian, or if you need to explain what that means, it's very exhausting. So that's kind of what I mean by cultural. So there's different kind of ways to go at it, but I think I've experienced both what it means to live in a place like this, where it's uncommon to go to church or identify as a Christian, and there's been a bit of an orphaning culturally, but also have experienced a spiritual orphaning where I have had trouble finding a true kind of authentic expression of faith in kind of larger cultural Christianity.
And obviously a big part of what, I mean, I think this book could apply to anyone, could read it, but a big part of this is generational. And so you kind of out yourself in the book as a late Gen Xer. We often talk about millennials, which I'm a very early millennial, but there's a lot of late Gen Xers and millennials that are experiencing this. What's happening generationally, culturally, that's really important for understanding where you're writing from in this book?
Yeah, that's a great question. I think I'm like a Xennial or a member of the Oregon Trail generation. There's this interesting.
Yeah, I've heard people like talk about this, like, so that we have the last few years of Gen X, the first few years of millennials have the cynicism of Gen X and the optimism of millennials. So we're like hopeful cynics or something, or
I kind of
hopefuls.
Love it.
Honestly. I don't know. I embrace that.
Totally. That's funny. Well, yeah, my mind really snaps to looking at generational trends or characteristics. I think that's fascinating from a research perspective or from a journalistic perspective. So I always, it's important to start by saying, obviously, generation is one arrow pointing to some of our cultural experiences. But really, there are certainly examples of boomers that would sort of buck the trend of things that the Pew statistics would tell us or a Gallup poll would tell us. So really, there's obviously nuance in our lived experience. But typically, in the book, I spend a lot of time looking at the sort of what happened to the boomer generation, which includes my mom and dad, a generation coming up in a really politically intense time during Vietnam, during the Cold War, like the Russia scare and the Cold War, and how broader things happening in American culture, narratives of kind of this fear of the enemy might feed into some of the ways that boomers might approach Christianity. And so the first part of the book talks about end times culture. I'm an end times kid, my husband grew up hearing a lot about the world ending in a kind of Hal Lindsey rapture style, premillennial dispensationalist kind of bent. And so really wanted to understand, why did that kind of way of thinking catch on? So I kind of looked at boomers and tried to understand, I hope with tenderness and nuance and curiosity, like what happened with boomers when it came to consumerism? Like, why did my church kind of feel the same culturally as the mall? I mean, I grew up going to the mall on Saturdays and church on Sundays. And why was there a market around daddy-daughter dances and promise rings? So there's an interesting generational thing that happened that reflects the market, just like every generation. You can say the same thing now about wellness and millennials, right? Or avocado toast. But I just had a lot of curiosity about what happened in the 80s and 90s when I was growing up specifically with parents as boomers, coming up as that sort of mildly cynical and optimistic Gen Xer that really formed my experience, which was light on spiritual formation in the church, but certainly influenced by culture wars and single issue voting and end times culture and some of those pieces.
I just need to clarify. So what's wrong with avocado toast?
No, avocado fans here. Nothing. Everything is right about it. But isn't it funny how it's this like kind of moniker, the millennial?
I'm not sure I've ever even had avocado toast, but it is the like moniker that's given to millennials. So funny. Whatever.
Yeah, it's a t-shirt.
But it sounds good. I mean, I'll admit it sounds good. So, I mean, you know, one of the things I think is really important, what you're just talking about there is, anyone who's paid attention to church trends knows this. There's people talking about millennials aren't going to church, right? We don't go to church at the level of previous generations. And clearly something has happened. And Gen Z has moved even further in that direction. And there's all the articles in the books about, you know, what's wrong with millennials? What's wrong with Gen Z? And, you know, and of course, what you're reminding us then is actually there's, if a generation has changed, we weren't born that way. We were cultured that way. Mm-hmm. It was the environment, not genetics. Mm-hmm. And so you're actually taking it back and saying, okay, wait a minute, what were the boomers doing? What were they teaching? What was the model of church and faith that they were presenting to us at that time? And I think that's a really important to get to the heart of what actually has changed our religious culture.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, coming up, you know, on my 18th birthday, I went with my dad to the Ellen County Republican headquarters in Fort Wayne, Indiana, and was registered as a card-carrying Republican. And then we went next door to Fort Wayne's famous Coney Island and had chili dogs, like, to celebrate. Like, there was never a question that my identity as an evangelical and my path forward as a newly minted adult would be glued together, specifically around abortion. And so that was something that we talked more about abortion, I think, in our house than we talked about a lot of really formative pieces of prayer or scripture. We really knew how to get riled up and what to listen to in culture. I mean, we listened to Christian radio and the Bible Answer Man and John MacArthur and Focus on the Family. Like, we heard these same messages of satanic panic or fear of backmasking on records. We heard about being worried about certain art like Serrano or Robert Mapplethorpe that are threatening the church. So we took a posture of sort of being ready for the enemy and being reactive. And also we began to feel exceptional, or like we had a way forward that was not only wise, but also sort of better. And so this sort of play between exceptionalism and sort of being cloistered really took hold. But again, for some families, that meant homeschool in that kind of 80s way or a kind of like coming off the grid. Weirdly, for my family, that also meant immersion in pop culture and certainly like loving TGIF on Fridays and eating sugary cereal. So interestingly, our life did not look different than any other kind of American suburban white middle-class family. And our values were Christian cultural values more than anything else. I mean, again, going back to nuance, like I will say, certainly my parents introduced me to Jesus and a love for the church. And so it's complicated, right? And who knows what I'll be telling my kids and what my kids will say, Mom, you really just hit too hard on Christian nationalism. And, you know, so it's, you know, so there's nuance there. But so my parents did their best and we had a lot of love. But certainly we've talked through the years about ways that we could have kind of changed some of that culture in our family.
I look forward to in 30 years interviewing your kids about their book about you and our generation.
I think about that all the time. That's funny.
So, I mean, you primarily talk about three big picture areas of ways that you individually as well as culturally were being raised. And I mean, one of the things, obviously, we're not going to be able to get into detail into a lot of this, but one of the things I really enjoy that you do is that you for those that maybe aren't familiar or didn't grow up in the same, you know, subculture that we both grew up in, you give enough background information for them to be like, oh, okay, yeah, maybe I've heard of this person and now I understand some of the key, you know, ideas. But then you also have very rich personal stories that are in there as well. And so the first big picture area that you talk about is end times.
Yeah.
And so let's set the stage. You know, for those of us who were growing up in the 80s and the 90s in the church, we're not supposed to still be here, right?
That's right. We're not. We are supposed to have left about 20 or 30 years ago, but we're still here.
Wait, were we left behind? I thought I was ready.
Totally. Yeah. Yeah. Well, my dad grew up in a Reformed Jewish household in Indiana, but ended up being saved pretty radically in the 70s around a Bible study looking at some prophecy in the book of Daniel, Daniel 6. And then also we're reading this book, The Late Great Planet Earth by Hal Lindsey, which at the time was like a mega bestseller on the New York Times bestseller list above The Joy of Sex. It was like in the water in the 70s and 80s. And a lot of folks, like my dad, I think read very few books, but he had the Bible and he had The Late Great Planet Earth. And so what was happening in larger culture, again, around the threat of Russia or the fear of, you know, a lot of big movies and Hollywood stuff was talking about apocalyptic themes or trends or the world ending. And certainly Christian media with the Left Behind series, and then with various movies and Christian scare movies like A Thief in the Night that were shown in youth groups around the globe, really were catching on. Did you ever see any of those in youth group, by the way? Any of those movies?
Oh, yeah. We watched The Thief in the Night in youth group. And I mean, I can already hear the music, you know, in my head. You know, I haven't seen it in a decade or better.
I rewatched when researching the book and had forgotten about the guillotine scene in one of them. It's very scary. And, you know, as we're growing and our brains are forming, it's like a really intense thing. So researching what was going on culturally in end times was interesting because it's such a, again, like a trope. It's such a kind of wacky thing to think about now in 2023. To look back on those times, it just seems campy. And how could anyone have taken it seriously? But when you're young and being formed, it can be pretty terrifying. I mean, one of my earliest memories, I mean, my dad was talking to me about this stuff when I was maybe 3 or 4 years old. And I remember being in my living room alone one day and like tracing 666 on my forehead because I was told by my dad that's how people would accept the mark of the beast. And then running and finding my mom doing laundry in the backyard, hanging laundry and like weeping and saying like, mom, I'm going to hell. I mean, as a very young child. So it's like trying to unpack that stuff. You know, my husband remembers his dad told him, this is in Maryland in the 80s, that he wouldn't grow up to start a family or have a career because Jesus was coming. And he just started to, like, he laid down and just started weeping, you know? And so there's just a lot of trauma from a lot of folks in our generation who had those experiences. And then there was a sense of anticipation. I had a friend that looked at the sky and there was a really intense sunset one day. And she thought, maybe the world's going to end now. I have to go see if my family's inside. You know, so just a lot of anxiety. So really that era, I think, produced... also, this just sense of, again, like feeling exceptional. So as a young kid, I heard these messages, had a lot of fear. But then there's this feeling like, oh, we're kind of onto something. Like we know Jesus will literally return in our lifetime and we will be raptured and we will miss the 7-year tribulation period and everything that comes after it. You know, and so there was this feeling of kind of like, we need to save our friends and family that don't believe this. And it's great that we're going up. So maybe Earth Day is not that important. If the world's going to burn anyways, maybe we don't have to take care of it. So, you know, creation care was certainly not top of mind. And so there's also a feeling of individualism. We needed to make sure our family was going to be okay and then do our best to spread the word. So there are all sorts of negative messages that link to individualism and sort of safety and security, and inner, like an inner focus that came through coming up as an end times kid.
Yeah. And I mean, you talk about how this, you know, can be traumatic, you know, growing up with this, and you kind of unpack some of that as well. In fact, you asked a question in the book, and I'm going to turn around and just ask it to you. When do bad theology and frenzied faith become spiritual abuse?
Yeah. Yeah. I know. It's a good question. I mean, if I think about,
I mean, I hope you think it's a good question. You wrote it.
Yeah, I mean,
I won't take credit for that one.
That's an awesome question. I wonder who wrote that. you know, there are ways that I've processed what happened as a kid, and ways that, you know, the conversations my dad and I have had since then. He has admitted and apologized. He said, if I could go back and do something different, I would never have talked about the end times with you like I did. So, you know, we've worked through some of that. But he still believes fully that Jesus will return in his lifetime. You know, I write about in the book how my dad has a treatable but incurable cancer, and he still fully believes, even though his lifespan has been marked at on average about 3 years with his myeloma, with his staging, that he will not die. And so that feeling of dad wanting to maybe escape pain or suffering, the way that that's still infused in him, has been an interesting dynamic interpersonally. So I think, you know, the answer is, yeah, I think that it is abusive. I think there is spiritual abuse and end times trauma. But I also think that it's an interesting kind of personal experience and journey, how we process that, how we work through that in therapy, how we talk to our family about it, where we go from there. So, you know, I think our invitation is to get to a place where we can work through some of those pieces that are complicated and emotionally hard to sort of move forward. And so I've really tried to think about eschatology and how to have a right view of Jesus coming back. I read the book of Revelation now as symbol, but also as a piece of like social justice. And I read ways that we can wonderfully look to everything being made right and set new again whenever Jesus comes back, which I think is so beautiful and transformative. So I've been able to kind of enter in a different way to that text.
I mean, that's one of the things I really appreciate about your book. I mean, I think, there's been a lot of kind of ex-evangelical, you know, voices out there, and some of them can be pretty strident. And the stories you tell, both of your childhood and then, you know, more recently, you know, with your parents, there's just some gorgeous stories of you and your father driving on a Pentecost to the beach because he thought Jesus was coming back. And I appreciate the way that you kind of live in the messiness of like, I don't want to necessarily, you know, live this type of faith, but then also still, you know, showing the love and respect for, you know, your parents. It really makes the book really fascinating and enjoyable to read.
You know, thanks so much. I mean, I think that instead of burning it all down, like the work that I think some of us are called to is to like raise up, to kind of surface what's wrong in the American church right now, because we love the church, because we believe that if what Jesus said is true, like Jesus left us with the church. It's the best that we have. And us folks have, like, a lot of us have made a fine mess out of it. But like, if we have hearts burning to change, if we can do that work, I think that is important to do. So for me, it's about surfacing what happened with end times culture and other stuff to bring us back around to Jesus.
Yeah. So you wrote about this, you know, in kind of in reflecting on the apocalypse, and you just mentioned that, you know, you read Revelation, you know, more symbolically now, and you know, you talk about in the book about COVID being apocalyptic as an unveiling, and you write, I believe in true apocalypse. I believe in a full uncovering of what is wrong to lead us to new longings, to best practices for rest, even as we lose and lose and lose, because in the losing, there is nothing hidden. In full plain light, there is hope for restoration, no matter what afflictions we have before us. There is no escape from human suffering in the end, but God's Spirit is a revelator, resting near the broken in body, heart, and mind.
Yeah, well, you know, I think that for a lot of my life, I tried to avoid hard things or suffering. There's this scene in As Good As It Gets, that Jack Nicholson film from the 90s that I love so much. He's driving to Baltimore with Helen Hunt and Craig Kinnear, and he says, essentially, some people their lives are like picnics with noodle salad, where everything's pretty and perfect. And then he looks around and he says, just nobody in this car. And I just love that scene. And I love that how he deadpan says it. But I think for a lot of time, I wanted my life to be noodle salad. I wanted to avoid suffering. I wanted to be raptured as a kid so I didn't have to be here when things got hard. I now see as a 40-something adult the nearness of God in our suffering, the humanity and empathy that comes through brokenness, the good work of justice that comes by looking around where we are and doing the work that we can with people in our very lives and neighborhoods. So in a way, the hard stuff, I think, is where we grow and change. And sometimes I think, what if those of us that want the church to be better work our whole lives and we never see that happen? Like, what if we never do? And I guess that's, you know, that's okay. Like, it's not about us seeing the fruit of work. It's about us being faithful in this generation and saying, like, if Jesus is real, like, if I'm a Christian, if I'm not building my life on a myth, like if there really was a virgin birth and a resurrection, like if the whole thing is true, like I want to live faithfully. And so many of us want to live faithfully and believe that if it's true, it means that it can change us and it can make us better so that we can serve other people, not so that we can avoid suffering or hardship.
So then, you know, that's the end times. And I know we could probably spend a lot more time talking about the end times, but we'll before either one of us get PTSD, we'll move on to the next big picture area that you talked about. And that's the culture wars. And if there's anything that defines American evangelical Christianity in the 80s and 90s, the culture wars is probably one of the first things people will think of. But why don't we set the stage? When you're talking about the culture wars and you know, growing up in this milieu, what's going on for you?
Yeah, I mean, the making of the myth that Christianity and republicanism are synonymous or inseparable, or that if you're a Christian, if you're an evangelical, you vote a certain way, is really not that old of a story. I mean, it's, you know, Carter was a Southern Democrat evangelical in the 70s, then Reagan kind of came using a lot of apocalyptic rhetoric and really capturing the imagination of the evangelical voting bloc around the same time there was the rise of the moral majority. And so for a long time, and I think it's been, you know, pretty widely written about now, it's not a new idea. Like, evangelicals were not on fire about abortion. There were political strategists like Paul Weyrich trying to find just like throwing pasta at a wall and trying to find a topic that would stick to energize the evangelical base. And so because my entire life and my formative years were spent in the Republican Christian moral evangelical moral majority, I have to remind myself it hasn't always been like that. In fact, for the long arc of historic Christianity, long before America, like the message of Jesus certainly spread and grew. So I try to think about that. And I also, of course, think about our American context and how in global expressions of faith, the global South and in other parts of the world right now, the idea of Christian thought and life and faithfulness looks different than it does here. But, you know, just looping back to the 80s and 90s. So really, there was certainly a cultural pressure that I think threads well into today. That can easily get kind of hyped up, especially as American demographics change and we are not a majority white country. And a lot of folks are theoretically, you know, or a lot of white evangelicals, I think, may have some fear or may express concern about those changing demographics and what that means for our Christian nation. Can being convinced that God has blessed America especially, and that there's some kind of American exceptionalism. So I think that the 80s and 90s have kind of led to where we are today with nationalism and with a lot of rhetoric that I think has moved into violence and racism.
Yeah, I wanted to highlight a couple of things on the culture wars, and you've already referenced the issue of abortion being dominant political mobilizing issue. And as you're writing about that, you say, when we tie up faith with a single issue, the church is impoverished. Doing so boils down the Christian tradition in its rich global expressions and history to one focal point, as if Jesus came 2,000 years ago simply to transform U.S. laws around reproductive health. That energy could have gone into the church and worked for a flourishing in a myriad of ways. Instead, cynicism and skepticism took root. Mm-hmm. I don't even talk about that because, you know, on the one hand, we're talking a few months after for many activists in the movement, you know, they see that they won. There's this victory. And you're suggesting that perhaps it was a Pyrrhic victory at best, that they really actually lost quite a bit.
Yeah. I mean, you know, when we think about the terms, obviously pro-life and anti-choice are politicized terms, but if I guess I'll go with sanctity of life, if Christians believe that life begins at conception, if that is a true thing, that certainly means that we are called to have a whole life ethic from birth to beyond, you know. And my mom volunteered at a crisis pregnancy center, which is a kind of community center usually run by evangelicals to promote adoption and not abortion to young mothers. And every year we would get this Christmas card in the mail and put it on the fridge, and it would have the names of babies' lives that were saved. And so it was always like exciting to read the names and think about the card and like really beautiful. But then, you know, just like all the other cards every year, we'd put them in the trash. Like, we never once talked about or thought about what happened to those babies. Like, our job was to make sure that they were born and stayed alive. And then I just assumed as a kid or in high school, like, I guess the state would take care of them, or I guess they would just figure it out, or there's a foster family. Like, I really was very naive. But I our call now is, I think, as Christians, to certainly model a whole life ethic that thinks not just about abortion, but thinks about immigration, thinks about refugees, the plight of unhoused people. We need to think about how to support the flourishing of all of us at all stages of life. So that's really, really what I'm getting at there.
And then you also alluded to a moment ago, you know, thinking about violence. You have a whole chapter particularly focused on what happened on January 6th. I also happen to note that we are recording this conversation on the afternoon of January 6th, the second anniversary. And this was your choice. You chose this time. Yes. So, you know, you have to talk about it now. No, I mean, let's reflect on January 6th. This will come out in a couple of weeks, but, you know, it's still very fresh, obviously. And, you know, while the January 6th House Committee didn't talk about Christian nationalism, the report didn't really talk about Christian nationalism, many others have. We've written a lot about it at Word and Way and our email newsletter, Public Witness. I've had other guests here, you know, Andrew Whitehead and Sam Perry and Robert Jones and others who have talked about it on the podcast. And so we know it's a thing. And for a lot of people, when they think of Christians today, one of the images that comes to mind is the mob attacking the Capitol.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, I was reflecting today about how it's been 2 years since the insurrection. Even a year ago, I think that folks that, you know, many of my family members would relate to kind of God and country rhetoric, would not be able to differentiate a healthy patriotism from a distortion of and a conflation of the church and politics that nationalism is telling us that we should accept or receive. And so my family members would not have been at the Capitol insurrection 2 years ago today. They would not have like held a Jesus 2020 banner or a wooden cross. That they would not have publicly done that. But many of these messages are resonating with friends and family, even if they're not talking about them publicly. I have many relationships where that's true. And so, interestingly, when the insurrection happened, and even a year ago, I don't think anybody would have talked about that with pride or used the term Christian nationalism positively. But like, as we've seen with some popular books that have come out and some rhetoric on Twitter, there's a sense of kind of brazen, bold unity from some folks around the idea of identifying as Christian nationalists, you know? And so we know that Christianity is 2,000 years old and that it's a historic faith again, but the idea that we can make America great again by somehow maintaining white dominance, or by somehow maintaining this kind of promise, kind of like the Israel's in exile, we're promised a home, we're promised a homeland, is really dangerous. And it's just so strange that it's 2 years later and I don't think it's getting any better. In fact, it's getting worse, and it's more important that Christians stand against nationalism, even because I think that the term Christian, a lot of folks are not using, because I think it has been co-opted in a lot of circles by white nationalists, you know? And so I think even starting with I'm a Christian, I think it's important to reclaim and sort of be unified around common language to sort of push back against distortions of our historic faith. So that's a few things of what I guess that's where I'd start. I mean, I feel like I could talk about this forever and ever. And especially today, it's really been on my mind.
Yeah, well, I've been accused of talking about it forever and ever as well. So we might need to move on.
I was talking to a friend, we were thinking about doing some Instagram posts about it. And I thought, are people sick of this? Does everyone know? But every time I post something about it, there's confusion. People don't understand specifically what that term means or why it's dangerous. And it kind of sounds like a good thing, right? So there's a lot of education I think we still need to do. And I assume that's already happened, but I don't think that it has.
I think that's right. And I think also because for those of us who grew up in the 80s and 90s, and honestly, for those who grew up in decades before that as well, there was a lot of soft mixing of God and country, church and state, Christian nationalism. If you grew up in a white church, particularly a white evangelical church, even a white Catholic church, many white mainline Protestant churches, it's just in the air that we breathe. I mean, it's in the songs and our hymnals. It was, you know, on stage with the flags, right? And so it takes a lot of time to detox that, to unlearn that. And so, I mean, I think we shouldn't be surprised that 2 years later, we're like still trying to help people recognize what Christian nationalism is and how it's not actually Christian.
Yep, that's right. Yeah, I mean, the gospel message is for all people of all times and all places. There is nothing special about God's love for America. We are not set apart to be like a modern Israel. We are people that are broken, doing our best, trying to model through our lives that if what Jesus is offering is real, maybe there's hope there. Maybe we can make a change. You know, that's what it boils down to for me.
We'll be right back with the rest of this conversation. But first, I want to remind you that you should subscribe to Warden Way's award-winning e-newsletter, A Public Witness. It will help you make sense of the world of faith, culture, and politics. Learn more and subscribe today at publicwitness.wardenway.org. And now, back to our conversation.
And then the other thing that you write about in the culture war section is also the kind of the irony of, or maybe irony is not the right word, but though you're lamenting of, you know, we were taught that these issues mattered and this is what the religious right focused on. And there were so many other areas that Jesus and the prophets are talking about, you know, helping the poor, war, and, you know, all these other topics that for some reason didn't become part of the quote Christian perspective in politics today.
Yeah. I mean, for me, what that boils down to is that my formation was as much a cultural and political formation as it was around the gospel message. Jesus being like a brown-skinned refugee that lived a radical life and did radical things. We learned stories in Sunday school about John the Baptist eating locust and honey. Like we learned the stories and they were compelling. But by the time I became a sort of Gen X cynical teenager or began to question some of what my parents were telling me, like so much of it didn't what I was hearing on Sunday did not hold true because I did not have a sort of grounded basis of what it means to really be formed around a faith, you know, and around a faith community. And that's the other thing. I mean, church obviously is complicated for a lot of people right now, but the fact that we get to be with people we maybe wouldn't choose and show up, even if maybe we don't feel like it, like the way that broken people can come together, really honestly, that just wasn't at when church is at its healthiest, was not modeled for me. It was really, it felt performative and just kind of hollow, you know? And so there were good people there that loved Jesus, just like my parents, but something got lost in translation. We were just so focused on issues and so unfocused on being uncomfortably changed in beautiful ways by the message and work of Jesus.
I love that way that you just put that. I mean, it's not a weapon for more political power, but this idea of being challenged and unsettled by the difficult but beautiful way and words of Jesus. And I mean, that's what you're trying to offer us in this book, is that it doesn't have to be this way.
It makes me uncomfortable all the time.
If you're comfortable, maybe you're not listening to Jesus.
I'm going to highlight that, double click on that one. Yeah.
So then our third big picture area that you bring to us that we were raised on in the church of the 80s and 90s and the Christian culture of that time is consumerism. And you've taken on end times theology, politics, but now you're going after like the real idol here, right? Mammon. I mean, now you're really moved from, you know, preaching to meddling. So what's this consumerism that you speak of?
Yeah, I mean, like I've mentioned before coming up, we were white and middle class, and the way we lived looked just like everyone else. And seeing how the church kind of mirrored that larger piece of the market was really interesting, especially upon reflection. You know, like the conferences, the sort of big conferences and stadiums that we could go to, Christian summer camps, again, like the merchandise that we could buy, branded Bibles. There's just such a clear market around the church in ways that feel, I mean, the word that comes to mind is gross. And I've only seen that amplify and magnify today with like smoke machines on stage at mega churches. And I don't know if you saw that video of like the flying drummers a couple weeks ago for like a Christmas pageant, but just like spectacle.
Wait, your church doesn't have flying drummer angels?
Oh my goodness. My church has everyone that likes folk music and kind of sad liturgy. We're very bookish. I love that.
Come to our church. We have sad liturgy. Good on the sign out front.
Oh Lord, I can't get that contrast out of my head. But the idea that I'm sorry, I'm so stuck on the drummers. I totally lost my train of thought.
I love the drummer angels. In like a horrible way. I would never go to that church, but I love making fun of the flying drummer angels.
I watch that video again and again. But you know, like in the book, I talk about the aspirational class, which is this work from a researcher named Elizabeth Creed Hackett. And she talks about how before, like in the 80s and 90s, signs of affluence were a lot more visible, like silver spoons or like Mercedes cars or whatever. And now in culture, that's shifted to being more about lifestyle and wellness. Maybe I go to Whole Foods or I go to bar class or I breastfeed my baby. Like I do all of those things. Those are not bad things, but like, what does that identify about the culture I'm aspiring to? There's this way in the church, especially on social media, where wellness has kind of gotten kind of mixed up and glommed together with like actual radical Christian teaching and thought, where good theology has become kind of muddied with ideas about, name it and claim it, kind of like church culture that tells us that if we just try or we're good enough that we can get what we want, or that Jesus will bless us, you know, prosperity gospel stuff. So just like seeing threads of that started in my childhood that really I can tug on today, it's concerning. Because the other thing, not to go too hard into social media, but the way that anybody can have an influencer voice and that we can kind of find these sort of little examples of people that are trying to sell us the gospel mixed in with like essential oils, you know, or like the gospel, like if you spend $2,000 on this course for wholeness, or like maybe you're a green juice away, like a green juice and a Bible study away. They all just go together really well hand in hand. So just really trying to parse out what happened and why. And more importantly, like how do we live differently? Like maybe we're not all called to sell all of our possessions. Maybe it's not practical for us to leave our communities and to go on the road and to like, I don't know, like maybe what is reasonable and practical and what are we called to? So those are some of the pieces I'm trying to explore in that section.
Yeah. I mean, I think I just lost essential oils and green juice as sponsors of the podcast, but other than that, it was a great answer.
I know. Again, I could have a green juice right now. I mean, just to be clear, I'm pro green juice.
I mean, you're in Seattle, right? I mean, you know, that sounds like this is your vibe.
total green juice capital.
No, one of the things I appreciate what you just said in that answer, and then you do in the book as well, is, I mean, you're talking about our culture. Our culture, I mean, I don't think this is a surprise to anyone, but American culture is very consumeristic, very capitalistic. But you're also noting how the church and our church culture has embraced and adopted those values. And so, you know, we have not, this is an area where we have definitely not been countercultural. Yeah. You know, we're talking with the big pageants and the shows and the products and the merchandise and, you know, the big buildings and the camps and all that. You know, there's something that has happened that we have become a mirror image of our own culture just with a little bit more prayer and music.
Yeah, that's right. Or another version of that is how a lot of, specifically, I've noticed a lot of women, a lot of Christian women, some Mormon women, like modeling this idea of kind of going off the grid, like homeschooling in beautiful classrooms, just like setting this bar of kind of like, we're messy, but kind of curated messy. So I think that, you know, with consumerism, the church is modeling broader consumer culture, but also modeling this kind of nuanced version, this almost imperfect perfection that makes just about anyone that looks at that feel like they're not enough, or they're not doing enough, they're not praying enough. Maybe they're, instead of being one juice away from feeling better, like maybe they're one homeschool study away from having perfect kids. Again, plenty of friends that homeschool. This isn't about homeschool. It's about the culture that comes around that sometimes. So there's this interesting nuance, I think, with a lot of white evangelical women where there's just a bar that's set that is really unattainable and really brings a lot of like shame on people that are just trying to do their best or that are trying to feed their family. It's interesting.
So you lay out all of these things. And I mean, some people might lay out these examples and these issues and say, and that's why I've walked away.
Yeah.
That's why I don't go to church. That's why I don't call myself a Christian. And this, you didn't take that direction. So why do you stay?
I stay because where else would I go? I mean, I stay because underneath everything else, the message of Jesus I have found to be compelling and true and grounding. It is not about me. It is not about me actualizing my best self. In fact, the harder I try to do that, the more I fail. Like the idea that we can give up this idea of self, sort of promotion, that kind of gross idea of branding ourselves in a certain way that we're all trying to make it to the next level. Like it's just, there's just no BS. I don't find any BS in Jesus. Like I just find this invitation to get out of our heads and to actually serve other people around us and to show up. I can't find that anywhere else, you know? And the other thing I would say is like, for me, you know, about 5 years ago, I became interested. This is certainly a trend, but like a lot of folks in contemplative Christian practices, listening prayer, Lectio Divina, started doing spiritual direction, just realized that the way that I've learned how to pray and to be quiet and to take time and discipline around some of those practices has been really personally transforming, and it's gotten me out of my head and made me realize like, how can I raise kids up differently? How can I try to show up differently? Like not by putting on a show, but saying like, just like all of us, we're just real people doing our best that are trying to live differently. And there's something so compelling and beautiful and countercultural about the Christian story that I can't let it go. And in fact, I'm all in. So ironically, this entire exploration of these topics has drawn me closer to pursuing Jesus while I continue to find many things to call out and pray and hope will transform within American Christianity.
It's the perfect mix of cynicism and hopefulness and optimism.
I love that we came back. Yeah, it's my Gen X-ness. Love it.
I mean, no, all seriousness, I mean, you do it. You have a hopeful note. I mean, you write in the book, we need the church, and whatever the state of the American church, it needs us. Our relationship with the church is reciprocal. The church can flourish again. In quiet corners, it has never ceased to flourish. Millions of Christians are worshiping around the world, especially in the global South. Christianity requires us to be carried outside of ourselves and beyond ourselves, to acknowledge there is a being who loves us and is completely other, a God who is outside of us and not in our control.
Yeah. Yeah. And if that is true, then the question is, how do we continue to piece apart, how do we continue to be a true witness to Jesus instead of being a part of a church that has in some ways become a kind of culturally co-opted part of the American experiment? Like, how do we move forward in faithfulness and in hope while just being okay with things being messy for a little while? You know, like, if I look around right now, people like us are talking because I think those of us that have hearts burning for change, those of us that believe transformation can happen whenever and however it does, like, if we can do that work, I think that's such a beautiful thing. So I really do feel hopeful. I feel realistic. I'm realistically hopeful looking ahead. And I can say that even on the 2-year anniversary of the insurrection.
I mean, that's like true hopefulness right there. Well, before we close up, I wanted to give people a chance not only obviously to pick up the book as it comes out, but also find other ways of following you if they want to. I know that you write a Substack newsletter, Bitter Scroll.
Yeah.
That's a good name and a good biblical allusion in there as well. But what will people find there, and where else would you like them to connect with you?
Yeah, thank you. Well, I write on Substack about once a month on faith and culture. With at Bitter Scroll. And then I'm also mostly active on Instagram at sarah.billups. I'd love to connect with anyone. Thanks for asking.
And you curate on Instagram your like beautiful, messy, you know, slightly imperfect life. Is that right? Is that the goal there? The influencer, the Christian influencer?
Yeah. I can't wait for folks to see my beautiful, messy curated life on it. That's so good. You might find like one or two green juice shots like mixed in. So who knows?
Uh-oh. I thought we were against green juice. I'm getting mixed messages here. Any essential oils?
There's a couple, but not a ton.
Now I feel like I can't even trust you.
Just kidding. No essential oils here. And we only have orange juice. So we're good.
Excellent. Well, the book is Orphaned Believers, How a Generation of Christian Exiles Can Find the Way Home. Really encourage people to check out this book. Sarah, thank you so much for joining us on the program.
Brian, thank you for having me. I've really appreciated this conversation.
Well, I hope you enjoyed this episode of Dangerous Dogma. You can find more information and links in the show notes at dogma.wordandway.org. And don't forget to check out our website, wordandway.org, to learn more about our other offerings, including A Public Witness, a subscriber e-newsletter to help you make sense of faith, culture, and politics. If you've enjoyed this episode, I hope that you will share it with your friends on Facebook and head over to iTunes or your favorite podcast platform and write a positive review. It really will help more people to find the show. If you'd like to give to support this program, we greatly appreciate it. And all you have to do at wordandway.org is hit the donate button. And whatever you give there will help support the production of this podcast, as well as our website, monthly magazine, and other offerings. If you have any comments or feedback about this program, you can send those to me at bkaylor@wordandway.org. Thanks for listening.